BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with Old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, martial arts judge and businessman Jerry Coulter is here with us in the studio. He's fought a running battle over the last 10 years with a religious cult called the Freemasons. At least some would call them a religious cult anyway. But first, due to I am allowed to talk to you about something to do with the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police. There are serious questions over the competency and ability of the Chief Constable in Avon and Somerset to command respect amongst his staff. Some actions of the Chief Constable Colin Port suggest a possible scant regard for the law. Last year, he approved an unlawful raid on expert witness and computer expert in the Home Counties, Jim Bates, who we interviewed on this show. And Colin Port ignored until the day before he was due to appear in the High Court to explain himself. A court order, and it's a High Court order from London, to return Mr. Bates' computer to him. Before he became Avon and Somerset's Chief Constable, Colin Port was assigned a special task in Northern Ireland to look into the assassination of Republican lawyer Rosemary Nelson, despite evidence of the involvement of British MI5 at the scene of Rosemary's assassination. After more than 18 months, Colin Port's inquiry uncovered very little of interest. There was strong criticism within Ireland itself that Port based his inquiry in the same RUC police station where officers were stationed and previously made death threats from that police station against Rosemary Nelson before she was assassinated. Chief Constable Colin Port was also accused of corruption in the House of Commons when his wife was paid a six-figure sum to project manage South West One, which was the privatisation of large parts of North Somerset District Council and also of Avon and Somerset Police, the civilian support service side of it. The South West One deal was done with US multinational IBM, who blotted their copybook back in the Second World War by leasing their card punch machines to Hitler's hated Gestapo, so that the Gestapo could, and this story is described in detail in award-winning war writer Edwin Black's book IBM and the Holocaust, round up Jews and other, quote, Untermensch, unquote. They were being rounded up all over occupied Europe and the cash was rolling in at IBM, a company Colin Port is happy to see take over much of the work at Avon and Somerset Police. Chief Constable Colin Port and his wife seemed to be happy then to do business with former Holocaust collaborators, despite reports in the Evening Post and elsewhere that IBM's much criticised SAP IT system is virtually unusable. Well, one person who's convinced that the Freemasons are an organised conspiracy infiltrating some organs of power in Britain is martial arts judge and businessman Jerry Coulter, and he's joining me now. Jerry, hi and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for bringing me on the show, Tony.
Now, tell me about your background in engineering and martial arts.
Well, basically, I've worked as an engineer since I left school back in the early 70s. I did an engineering apprenticeship, went to technical college, got my qualifications in engineering, and worked for various companies, not many, because obviously I worked for those firms for quite a long time. Then I went self-employed and founded my own engineering business.
So what sort of work do you do in your engineering?
All sorts of things, everything from R&D work, overhaul work, mainly power generation engines and industrial engines. Also, we do a lot with automotive side, Rolls-Royce products, and we support the old vehicles that Rolls-Royce no longer want to support or make parts for. And we're involved with all sorts of projects as well, projects engineering.
So, sounds like sort of old school type engineering.
Well, now, yeah.
What about the martial arts side?
The martial arts. Basically, when I was at school, I used to box for Middlesex Schools ABA. And again, in the early 70s, the Japanese came over, Japanese instructors came over, and we all started seeing karate, and later this was all followed by the kung fu movie boom and everything else in the late 70s and early 80s. But in the early 70s, a lot of us that were boxing, we made the transition from boxing to karate.
Why was that then?
Well, it was something new, basically, and instead of using both your arms, you used your legs as well.
Okay, so what brought the Freemasons to your attention?
Basically, the Freemasons were something that I had no interest in until 1995, when I had a Jeep nicked in Dorset. And I couldn't understand why, when I was trying to deal with Dorset Police and I was a victim of a car theft, I was trying to get support and help, because I couldn't understand why, with a car being stolen, reported in Hertfordshire, being told by Hertfordshire Police...
So was it actually stolen in Hertfordshire?
No, stolen in Dorset.
So you reported it when you got back home?
No, I reported it in Hertfordshire, because the car had been loaned to my Japanese brother-in-law, and a woman who knew him took my car and sold it to a car dealer with no logbook, no MOT and everything in Bournemouth, whose brother was a serving police sergeant in Dorset Police Force and a member of Branksome Lodge, who thought he could walk on water. And
well, surely the problem really wasn't with this Freemason, and it may be that's just pure coincidence, because she shouldn't have sold him the car.
Well, now you asked me how it started. I'm trying to tell you how it started, and then I'll get on to Freemasonry. When you follow the correct procedures and you're asking the police for help and you're getting people threatening you, bearing in mind at the time when I was getting threats of physical violence from a Sergeant Kelly, who was on duty in Bournemouth Police Station, who said to me, quote, "Don't come down here again looking for your vehicle. I wouldn't want to see you get hurt." And I just got off a plane back from Japan fighting at Nichidai, which is the Wadaru testing ground, where you hit very hard. I wanted to know who was going to hurt me. As an engineer and a logistician, reasonable question, which I put to him. And of course, he couldn't answer it. So I took that, not as a veiled threat, as a direct threat. Not only that, he invited several police officers to come out the canteen to have me thrown out at Bournemouth Police Station when I was the victim of a car theft, right? So I followed the correct procedures. From that point, I'm following proper procedures. I'm complaining to what was then called the Complaints and Discipline Department at Dorset Police Headquarters over it. Well, I'm a victim of a car theft and I'm being threatened, because I later find out, as I say, the car dealer, his brother, was a serving sergeant. I'm also hearing whispers when I'm being threatened by councillors on the police authority when I'm lobbying them. Again, I'm following correct procedures. When you're faced with something like police misconduct, these are the correct routes to go down. And if you try to follow these procedures, they then turn on you, almost for invoking the complaints procedure.
Well, maybe, you know, it just could be that you just upset one specific person. Is there any evidence that you have that this really was something to do with the Masons?
Well, when you start looking at it and you're hearing rumblings that this is all to do with Freemasonry, I'm an engineer and a logistician. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. And at the same time, I look at things pragmatically, because that's how I was trained. When you're heading R&D projects and things like that, you don't rule in anything, you don't rule anything out. So someone like me is exactly the sort of person who's going to get hold of one of their yearbooks, which gives the name and lodge number of every invested Freemason in Dorset.
But these yearbooks aren't easily obtainable, are they?
No, they're not easily obtainable, but you can obtain anything if you want to make a point of doing it, you know, legally as well, you know. So the point I'm making to you is, when I'm looking but all the councillors who've given me short shift and threatened me, when I'm looking at JPs that are handling the case against the people that stole my car, when I'm looking at people that are incumbent in the police force and in the police authority, and I find that these people are in three lodges. Out of all the hundreds of lodges in Dorset, it's all orbiting three lodges. 3366, 137 Amity Pool, and one other that I can't remember off the top of my head. But if you go to www.dorsetvictimsupport.org and go to Mason's Corner of the website, you can see it all. When I look and I start doing exercises, like I check all the magistrates in Dorset, and I find that the majority of them are in those three lodges, and I start looking at all the councillors on the planning committees in Dorset, and I find that the majority of them are in those three lodges, then I start looking at other council officers and I find that the majority of them are in those three lodges, and people in the predation service are in those three lodges. That, to me, looking at it pragmatically as an engineer and a logistician, are mathematical common denominators, those lodge numbers that are cause for alarm. They're disturbing. It's unhealthy.
But this isn't really good for honest Freemasons, is it? Because what you're saying is that there are certain, maybe certain Masonic lodges that have somehow become sort of ways that criminals could interact with each other. Do you think that's reasonable? Some lodges are good, some lodges are bad. And anyway, what is it that makes the lodge a place where criminal activity could possibly take place?
Well, it's not a question of criminal activity taking place. It's once something happens, once something goes down, and it's to do with brethren. When a Mason joins, the lowest level Mason joins Freemasonry, he swears an oath, quote, "I place my hand in a Master Mason's hand, and I promise to build a column of defence and protect a brother Mason at all costs," unquote. Right? So they are now under an obligation to protect each other. So when something goes down or something goes wrong, they are going to stick together, one, because of obligation. Two, they're members of this organisation that's hierarchical. They've got a status quo within Freemasonry. There are inferior and superior degrees. They have a lot of ritual. That ritual is a form of brainwashing. They buy into this. Every time they go through the floor work and the lodge, and the lower levels are not privy to what the upper levels are doing. They're only invited in and invited out of lodge as the lodge meeting takes place, depending on their level. And this whole thing about people being in a higher chair than you, if you are the very lowest level Freemason, the very, very lowest level Freemason of an inferior degree, made to feel inferior within your organisation because you're subordinate to superior degrees, who is going to be inferior to you? Us. Non-Masons. Logic. Logic dictates it has to. And all of these people in Freemasonry feel that the likes of you and I, a non-Mason, are inferior.
But this is only three lodges, Jerry, isn't it, in Dorset? And there must be at least 100 lodges in Dorset.
Yes,
so there are. It's only a tiny minority.
Yes, there are. But what is caused for concern to me... Let's understand something. Let's look at it pragmatically and logically. I've got no problem with businessmen, property developers, and people who are predators, which is what they are, right, using any form of business networking, be it Business Link, Freemasonry, the Rotary, or any other business forum, for them to network and them to move their business forward, because they're businessmen. Where I've got a problem is when I've got all the magistrates, all the councillors on the planning committees, all the property developers, all the council officers, a lot of the wives of those JPs who are also councillors, or councillors whose wives are also JPs, where we've one comes to mind, Councillor Gawson in Dorset, county councillor. His wife Elaine Gawson is a JP. He's in one of those lodges. When I find this, this to me is cause for alarm. There is no direct conspiracy there. But what I'm saying to you is, when the main incumbents that are controlling this county are in three lodges, you have got a problem there. And that problem is that the system is open to abuse. They are meeting, having dinner at the festive board. They're seeing each other socially at ladies' nights. And they will protect one another. If something goes wrong, like a stolen car and police misconduct, and you're complaining about it, don't expect to lobby any of the councillors to complain about brethren who are coppers.
Now, what happened with your car? Did you get it back eventually?
No, never. I had the car dealer. The police were telling me that I had to fight a civil suit to get a stolen car back. At the time, there was a national operation called Operation Bumblebee that was under the Home Office. Michael Howard was saying that stolen property had to be reunited back with the original owners. They had Shaw Taylor trying to find stuff that police had seized everywhere, showing it on TV in Hertfordshire so that people could come forward and get this property back. There was this national operation, and there was a stolen car that Dorset Police would not impound, and telling me that I had to fight a civil case to get a stolen car back, even when under duress the police had to prosecute the person who stole my car. And even when this woman pleaded guilty to the theft of giving my car over to the car dealer, whose brother was a serving police officer, right? That car, when she pleaded guilty, should have been impounded. And the head of the CPS was also asked to do it, and he ignored it. While this was going on, I had to find out, because Dorset Police were saying that I've got to start civil suit against the people that had my car. I had to find out who had my car. They knew who had my car. They'd interviewed the person that stole it. But because it was the brother of a serving copper, and everyone was covering up and helping each other, I had to find out who... They were telling me I had to fight a civil suit, but not telling me who I had to fight a civil suit against. So then I had to get private detectives involved. I had to spend a lot of money in legal fees. And when I finally found out, through DVLA, because this bugger had applied for duplicate logbooks to resell my vehicle, using lawyers to get this out of DVLA, because they won't give it to you if you try to phone up, right? And then I approached the car dealer and I say to him, man to man, look, I'll tell you what, I'll give you £1,000 for my car back, rather than piss around with lawyers and everything else. And he said to me, quote, you'll never get your car back. You can get whatever judgment you like against me, because your car is worth more to me in pieces. I'll chop it up and sell the bits. My car that was stolen was a Mediterranean model Suzuki Vitara Jeep convertible. It was white. It was colour-coded white. Even the instruments were white. It had white spot lamps, white ball bars. Everything was white. And it was a Mediterranean model. It wasn't built wide-bodied in Japan by Suzuki. It was built in Spain. And it was a wide-bodied version, not with a kit, with 15-inch-wide American Goodrich wheels on it. The wheels alone were worth £1,000 each. So he knew what he was saying was right. It was worth more chopped up. And my car was probably one of the only ones that came into this country, built in Spain as a Mediterranean model, as a right-hand drive car. So it was a modern classic. And that was why I had the vehicle.
So you discovered these three lodges that many of these people were involved in. What professions were they all? You mentioned magistrates, you mentioned police, you mentioned the garage owner too. What professions were the Freemasons who were in these particular three lodges that you discovered? What were they in?
Well, there were all sorts of people in all sorts of professions, like the councillors are in all sorts of professions. You were just talking to one earlier who's an accountant, right? The problem that I had is because I was being threatened by the police in Dorset, and literally directly being threatened, and putting pressure on them through London lawyers, costing me a fortune, presenting the evidence that they had to prosecute this woman that took my car for theft, and at the same time refusing to return the vehicle, refusing to even ask for a bench warrant for the magistrates to order the return of it when she was convicted of the theft, leaving me to fight a lawsuit with a bloke bragging to me that even if I fought that lawsuit, he was going to chop that car up. I'm reporting all this to the complaints department, and they're ignoring it. So I follow the correct procedure. I escalate the complaint. I complain to the deputy chief constable, because the head of the complaints department isn't taking the complaint or acting on the complaint or dealing with the complaint. In engineering, you could not do this. With ISO 9000 and all the things that I have to work to, if the complaint is being escalated, it has got to be dealt with. You can't fob it off and just ignore it. What is the point of employing ACPO officers on six-figure salaries in a complaints department, which is now called the Professional Standards Department? I call it the Double Standards Department. What is the point of having a complaints procedure and employing these people when you can't invoke that procedure? So when I'm complaining to the Deputy Chief Constable, who had an LLB in law and knew that he was supposed to be returning that vehicle, and said to me that the police had no power to impound that vehicle, when he knew damn well that they did under Section 19 of PACE at the time, which said, quote, so that they could impound any property believed to be stolen to stop it being lost, stolen, converted or destroyed. And then at the same time they're telling me that I've got to sue someone for conversion.
But I mean, surely this is an option for the police. They don't have to do that.
They did have to do it. There was a national campaign called Operation Bumblebee at the time. They had to do it. So, and then the Deputy Chief Constable lied about it. This is the misfeasance, the actual misconduct here. He lied knowing that he had the power to impound that car. So I, through lawyers, put in a complaint because they wouldn't even deal with me. There's no real reason why they can't deal with complaints. They are paid to deal with complaints of the public. Not say we're not going to talk to you, get lawyers on it, to quote them chapter and verse, which I'm now quoting to you because I've got a photographic memory as an engineer, and having spent £500 an hour for someone down the Temple to take Hawkesbury's Laws of England off the shelf and read me section 19 of Pace, when you're spending that sort of money, you remember it. And I'm having to pay for lawyers to talk to these people when they should have dealt with this. They should have been acting upon my complaints. I shouldn't have had to fought a civil action. And then what I'm trying to say is the misfeasance is when he was lying about it, and he's documented this, he even writes to my lawyers saying all this, I then make a complaint about the Deputy Chief Constable. This is not a complaint about administrative cock-up or direction and control of the force. This is direct misconduct. It is misfeasance. He had an LLB in law. He knew that he, one, there was Operation Bumblebee, two, which was coming down from the Home Office, two, he knew that section 19 of Pace clearly states, it's not arbitrary, it states that they should have impounded that vehicle, right? And then lying about it with an LLB in law that he had no power to do so. So I make a complaint to the Chief Constable that ignored all the letters. They never even replied to a single letter from my lawyers at all, just ignored them. So then we complained to the members of the police authority, and the, which are councillors, who were threatening me. So I started then looking at what they're doing. If you're going to treat me like a criminal who's a victim of a car theft, I'll look at what you're doing. And then I find that the councillors on the planning committee in these lodges are voting through their mates' planning applications, who are property developers in Dorset. Not once, but several times.
Now, we're coming on now to a film that you made with the BBC, BBC South in Southampton, aren't we? Because some of the connections that you found with planning, the local media down in Hampshire took quite an interest in.
Well, this is what I'm trying to say. When you look at it pragmatically, as an engineer and a logistician like me, if you're being threatened by these people, you start looking at what they're doing. If their character assassinated me, I'll look at them. And especially when people are telling me about Freemasonry, I looked at it pragmatically. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I looked at it. And I start looking in the planning record. I go down from Hertfordshire, where I live, to Dorset, and I found out X amount of property developers appear in the lodge books. Then I find out these councillors are not just Freemasons, they're in the exact same lodge as these developers. So talking to councillors in Hertfordshire that are straight, unlike councillors in Dorset that are bent, they tell me about the National Code of Local Government Conduct that was in force at the time. This is an SI, it is a statutory instrument. It's got statutory force. It is a legal, prosecutable thing if you breach it. It is misconduct. It is misfeasance, a common law criminal offence, prosecutable. I find that they're voting through, not once, but several times, planning applications for people in their own lodge that they know they should have abstained and stood down.
So basically you're saying that they should have declared an interest, saying that actually I'm a personal friend through my Masonic lodge of somebody who stands to benefit from this decision we're making in the planning committee.
Even if they're not a personal friend, they don't have to be a personal friend. If they know that that person is in their lodge, they have to stand down, even if they don't know that person as a friend. The fact that he's in their lodge, they should have nothing to do with it. They should declare an interest and stand down. We found that one councillor had voted through 13 planning applications for a person in his own lodge. That is a course of conduct that amounts to misconduct. The National Code of Local Government Conduct, which is a statutory instrument, is exactly that. I'll say that again. Code of conduct. If you breach a code of conduct, as a logistician, to me, that amounts to misconduct. Misconduct in public office is an indictable criminal offence. Misfeasance is its Latin name, its legal term. So I report all this to the police. Who do I have to report it to? Dorset Police, who are pissing in the same, sorry, who are in the same pot as the councillors. And they're all in on the police authority, on the criminal justice boards together. Everyone is incestuously linked in Dorset. So you can't actually get anywhere with your complaints or with your criminal allegations.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, not many people, Jerry, would have taken the time and trouble that you did to travel down from Hertfordshire to do all this research.
Well, the other thing that was going down at the time was there was a change of government. The Conservatives went out and Labour came in.
This is 1997.
Yeah, because it was 95, my car was stolen. So I then start telling the new government about what's going on. And they've got a committee headed by Chris Mullin. bearing in mind I've got a Dorset Masonic membership list, I've done the legwork, I've taken the list, I've got hold of a list of from Dorset of all the Dorset magistrates, and I've found an unhealthy number of them that are in those three lodges that I mentioned to you, which are common denominators. Numbers to me are mathematical common denominators, and these are common denominators that are cause for alarm. It doesn't mean to say there's anything untoward, but it's very unhealthy that these, that there's a high proportion of magistrates in Dorset in these lodges with the councillors who are the incumbent checks and balances in our society that are supposed to be controlling all these committees, like the police authority, the criminal justice board and everything else, you know, the people who are on it. And so I'm looking at this and I've done the legwork. I've found out all these councillors that are on the planning committee that are in these lodges, the magistrates that are in these lodges. And I try to give this evidence to Chris Mullin's committee. And I have still got the letters. I wrote to Mullin. Another one I wrote to was Robin Corbett, who was a MP in Hemel Hempstead at the time, living in Hemel Hempstead. And he was on Mullin's committee. He's now been put upstairs in the Lords. And all of them said, oh, send all this information in and it'll become part of the archive and we'll refer to it all. So I did. I sent it all to the committee chair, the committee secretary of the committee. But I also copied it to the members explaining what was going on in Dorset. And it should have been referred to. I also requested to actually give evidence to the committee, because one of the things that they were looking in was Freemasonry in the judiciary. Bearing in mind I'd found an unhealthy number of magistrates, male magistrates, in Dorset that were in these three lodges. I also found female magistrates who were the wives of Masons by looking at their husbands' initials and running them through the electoral roll, then running them through the lodge book and finding that they were in membership of Freemasonry.
Yeah, but there's no, really shouldn't be a problem with this, Jerry, because I mean, say for example, I mean, someone might be a member of a golf club, mightn't they, and also a magistrate, and they may have friends who are police.
Okay, yeah. I'll deal with that. And that's what you've just said is my argument. You've just encapsulated my argument. If you were a member of Dorchester Swimming Club, forget Freemasonry, let's say it doesn't exist, right? If you're a member of Dorset Freemasonry and you're a magistrate, and you know another bloke from the swimming club who after swimming comes in and goes to the bar, buys himself a pint, and all he does is nod at you or says hello, doesn't even buy you a drink. He knows you through Dorchester Swimming Club. The fact that he goes in the bar and nods at you, and the fact that you're both members of Dorchester Swimming Club, right, and you're a magistrate, if that person later comes up in front of you on the bench in a case that may well have some sort of, how can I put it, that someone's calling into question the integrity of the person that you know through Dorchester Swimming Club, you should stand yourself down. Magistrates rule state that you've got to stand yourself down. You can't hear that case. But if you go to the website, www.dorsetvictimsupport.org, and go to Mason's Corner, you will see the case of Barry Hunt. Barry Hunt of Weymouth always said he was being framed by evidence for a road traffic offence that took place in Preston Road outside the house of a magistrate whose house was being staked out by a copper on a motorcycle. This magistrate was the provincial Grand Master of Dorset Freemasons. He was also the chairman of the Magistrates Committee. His name is Harry Barnes. He then heard the case against Barry Hunt, who was stopped and charged by a PC Cully right outside Harry Barnes' house in Preston Road, Weymouth. Harry Barnes should have stood down. He shouldn't have heard that case. One, he knew Cully through membership of Freemasonry. And two, he was arrested. Barry Hunt was arrested almost, within spitting distance of Barnes' house in Preston Road. He still continued to hear that case. That was a judicial misconduct. It's been documented, it's been reported, nothing's been done about it. He hasn't even faced the investigation.
But surely that is actually a criminal offence, is it, to not stand down? Is that what you're saying?
It is misfeasance. It is misconduct in public office. He should have stood down. But this was the sort of example that I wanted to give to Mullins committee. I wasn't allowed to give any information. Instead, they had Martin Short there because he'd written a book. And any time the committee posed the question, he'd say, oh, that was dealt with on page 444 of my book, or page 217. In other words, he was using it as a platform to promote and sell his book. I had a Dorset Masonic membership list. I'd actually looked at how many councillors, how many magistrates, how many other people in public office were orbiting these three lodges, which was cause for concern, and I wasn't allowed to deliver this evidence. That is why I took it to the BBC, who later made a programme. But that programme should have been screened nationally, and someone high up in the BBC, it should have been a Southern Eye programme, it should have gone out right across the south of England, pulled the plug on it, and it was only ever screened around the Southampton era.
Now, I know it's on the internet. People want to watch it, the film. What's it called?
It's called Anything to Declare, and you can see it at www.dorsetpolice.tv. We now have our own TV channel showing documentary films.
Now, have Dorset Police done anything to... Because, I mean, if you've taken the domain name on the internet, Dorset Police, I would imagine that the Dorset Police themselves might not like that.
Well, one of the things that Dorset Police did to me, to divert from the criminal allegations I was making against them for misconduct, bearing in mind I'd complained about the complaints department to the deputy chief constable, who is ultimately responsible for the complaints department. I then complained about him to the chief constable, who ignored it. So then I started complaining to the police authority, and because I was getting nowhere, I bought the rights to www.dorsetpolice.com, and they then tried to bury me in civil litigation to divert from the complaints. And this is what they do. If you make a complaint in Dorset against senior officers, and this is one of the reasons why it's been in the news recently, why no chief constable or deputy chief constable has been prosecuted for misconduct for over 30 years, you're left in the hands of having to take it to the police authority. Well, the chairman of the police authority and the councillors on the police authority are all paid money from the ratepayers' money to support the chief constable. They go to all the civic receptions. They're sitting there whining and dining, drinking with them. They're
going
to all
the
meetings.
Are you saying that the police authorities are a little bit too cosy with the police that they're supposed to be overseeing?
Most certainly they don't want to rock the boat. They're there to support them. They're not there to have them disciplined or prosecuted. But if you look at the statutory instruments, like at that time it was PACE, dealing with it, they should have had my criminal allegations against the deputy chief constable and the chief constable sent to an outside force for investigation by an officer of the same rank, an ACPO officer, which meant it should have been overseen by a deputy chief constable of a metropolitan force somewhere like Greater Manchester or something like that, not just refusing to deal with the complaint. Also, they have statutory limits. They're supposed to investigate a criminal allegation that would involve a criminal or disciplinary offence within so many days, 120 days. They just ignored it went on for years, even with solicitors telling them that they haven't had a response in 3 months. You know, they just think that they can completely ignore statute law.
Now, Martin Summers is still with us. Martin's been sitting quietly listening for the last half hour or so. Martin, can we just get your take? Because just before Christmas, you did mention that the Freemasons are a sort of way that business people network. But obviously, if you're joining just an ordinary business club, there aren't the secret handshakes that go with Freemasonry.
Well, I think one of the things you've got to recognise is that, as Adam Smith long ago pointed out, business folk never get together even on social events when some conspiracy against the public isn't being cooked up. It's one of those things that happens, and that's why there have to be very strict rules about it, as Jerry's just been pointing out, but rules which are not, in fact, being enforced in this case.
The laws and the SIs are there.
Yeah, they're there. They're just
you can't invoke them.
It's what they call in Latin America impunidad, impunity. And of course the other thing is, when people are in public office, that's not a private business setup. That's public money, public resources being committed. I think Freemasonry, like and all these other networks, is open to abuse. And the most egregious abuse of Freemasonry that I'm aware of is the Propaganda Due Lodge in Italy, which was at the heart of the establishment in Italy. It had the head of the Secret Service, the Prime Minister, the top industrialists.
P2 Lodge.
Yeah. And they were very much behind the the strategy of tension in Italy, whereby bombs were planted, there was attempts to, you know, people were killed, assassinated.
What is the purpose of a strategy of tension?
The purpose of a strategy of tension is to achieve certain political effects. It wasn't just the Masons that were behind this. We're talking ultimately about the Western intelligence services using the Masonry, Freemasonry, as a tool.
The problem with P2 Lodge is it was endemic with government, and it was also supposedly involved with laundering, like you were talking about earlier, drug money through the Vatican Bank.
Yeah.
And there was an investigating magistrate, because unlike here, you don't have a CPS in Italy. Magistrates, when they're not sitting on the bench, actually have to do the public prosecutions. They have to investigate, and they have to put the case together to publicly prosecute. And one magistrate was investigating a guy called Gaudi, who was actually an Italian banker in London at that time. Mm. And Gaudi was subpoenaed to go back to Italy for interrogation by the investigating magistrate and the police. That magistrate was moved from his office to his home in an armoured car with a 24-hour SWAT team guarding him. Gaudi was never extradited. He was found hanging under London Bridge. London Bridge is where the tide ebbs. In Freemasonry, anyone that divulges any information about Freemasonry is supposed to have their tongue ripped out and buried at the ebb tide. And a lot of people have always said that the murder of Gaudi, or at least conspiracy theorists say the murder of Gaudi, had Masonic marks because he was found hanging where the tide ebbs in the Thames. It was bizarre. He supposedly hung himself, committed suicide, but the way he was strung up, it was very difficult for him to have done it on his own. And the fact that he was under or being subpoenaed to face interrogation over money laundering through the Vatican Bank and involving P2 Lodge, he was a member of P2 Lodge, as was various other government people and banking officials that were under investigation, and that there's this bizarre suicide, shortly followed by the magistrate who was transported by an armoured car. That armoured car was suddenly hit by a rocket supplied by Libya and made in the Soviet Union. All of that is very suspicious. That, to me, or to a lot of people, looking at it pragmatically and not as a conspiracy theorist, looks like a professional contract hit. Eastern European weapons supplied by a country that is outside, if you like, normal controls of what isn't allowed in normal protocols of diplomatic circles.
Well, Libya is almost a kind of a puppet state. It looks as if it's an enemy state, but it's actually very, very heavily infiltrated by Western intelligence. But I mean, the people want to follow this up. I mean, all you've got to do is a straightforward computer search, propaganda due, and I'd also mention, I always mention this, Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O. You will see that there is a very strong... It's not conspiracy theory. This is historical fact that we're talking about.
And I know that the Italians had a parliamentary inquiry.
There's been a parliamentary inquiry into all of this. These aren't theories. The fact is...
But nothing was done about P2 Lodge.
Nothing's done about it because these criminals are very highly connected at the highest levels with the state. And this is a real problem. We've now got a criminalised state in most of the Western world. Similarly in Eastern Europe. And it's partly to do with the drugs industry. It's partly to do with all sorts of other things. But the answer to this is to enforce the rules that already exist. That's what we should be doing. It's not for an armed struggle to be, I mean, some people in Italy entered into armed struggle against the state because they felt it was so corrupt, but of course they themselves were then manipulated by the same structures. Ultimately, it's about the rule of law, and we haven't got one in East Dorset or in many other places.
Well, we'll be hearing in a moment how Freemasons secretly recognise each other, and also how you get hold of these interesting little Masonic local yearbooks with all the lists of names in after this.
It's magic, you know. shaking my head. Crazy music playing in the morning.
With It's Magic, and I'm joined by Jerry Coulter, who's a victim of Masonic ill treatment, as well as being an engineer and also a martial arts and karate judge. Now, Jerry, you were talking about your website dorsetpolice.com, and you had a little bit of a debacle with Dorset Police over ownership of that domain name, didn't you?
Well, that's correct. Basically, because I couldn't get anywhere with lobbying the councils on the police authority or pursuing the complaints, even through lawyers, I thought the thing to do is publish it. And at the time, there was all sorts of things, people trying to use what was then in 95 new media, the internet, to publish grievances, because there's no point going to a newspaper and complaining about police misconduct. Even if a newspaper publishes it, the police and the police authorities don't care about bad publicity, because 24 hours later it's yesterday's news. That newspaper article's being used for someone polishing their boots on, you know, it's just gone.
Well, nowadays, of course, they are actually put pretty much permanently up on the internet.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. In 95, no, the web this wasn't happening. And I, of course, when you come out of an engineering background like I do, you're used to being in think tanks. When you're brainstorming problems and looking for solutions, this is what you do. You bounce it around with you. And so I'm bouncing it around with other people who are, if you like, not conspiracy theorists, but other logisticians that realise there's a rabbit away, if you like. There's something's not right. And so we looked at publishing on the net. So I thought, well, I'll dip my toe in the hot water and feel the temperature. So I... Dorset Police's domain is dorsetpolice.gov.uk, but search engines work alphabetically. The higher level domain is .com, so I bought the higher level domain of dorsetpolice.com and shut up a website. At the time, there was very little on it. In fact, there was hardly any material on it at all. Dorset Police then realised that because at that time the website was being uploaded by my brother-in-law in Japan, and it was on an American ISP, so it was all outside the UK, taking any action against me in the British courts would be futile, because even if they got a judgment against me, they wouldn't enforce it, because the website, although I'd bought the domain and registered it, I could quite easily transfer that domain into the name of my brother-in-law in Japan, who was operating the site. And the fact that it was on an American ISP, any court order telling the ISP to take the site down or disconnect the DNS domain forwarding wouldn't stand. because under American law you would be able to do it.
So what happened? Did you actually manage to keep your domain? And where was the final decision made?
Because of all this going on and the fact that cyberspace doesn't exist in any one country's domain, if you like, okay, you can take an action where the ISP is, wherever they're based, in this case it was America, and the site was loaded from Japan, they could fight me in Japan. They decided that they would fight me in America because in America they just put up a court, a tribunal, with the powers of the court, called ICANN, to police the internet. And it was set up in America by the American Trade Department. And the reason for its setting up was basically to protect trademarks and trade. So it was to stop people, if you like, taking a domain, say, of Bridgestone, which is a famous case. There's loads of ICANN precedent cases, Bridgestone tyres, and people like would take a domain. For example, I could buy the domain to www.bcfm, you've got .org.uk, I could buy .com, you know, or whatever. But it was mainly to do with protecting large organisations, to stop someone buying Polypec or something
like that. So what was your final decision by ICANN about domain?
Basically, ICANN had just been established, there were very few precedents, and I had one of the precedent cases, international precedent cases. Dorset Police and the British government started an action against me in the name of Dorset Police and the British government versus Coulter, because ICANN had the power to strip me of that domain, to actually take that domain from me, because all domains go through mostly American networking systems, so they can electronically strip you of that domain even though you've legally bought it and registered it, and they can hand that domain on to somebody else. And the ICANN's court's got the power to do this.
But dorsetpolice.com is still there, Jerry, so how did that happen?
How it happened is this. I had to fight case with the ICANN tribunal. At the time I started looking online and I found that the Harvard Law School were actually doing lectures on this very thing, how ICANN may be shutting down genuine freedom of expression to criticise the authorities, where you have a right under the First and Second Amendment to criticise them, and in Britain you've got the right under Article 10 of the European Human Rights Convention, and that's what I fought the case on. And I won.
Fantastic. Okay, now what about Freemasons and secret recognition? Because obviously you've come across quite a lot of stuff to do with Freemasonry. Have you spoken also to ex-Freemasons?
I've spoken to ex-Freemasons and incumbent Freemasons. Most of incumbent Freemasons think that people like myself and others that criticise them are someone that is to be treated with contempt, and a lot of them will treat you with contempt. Others will try to find out at least why you're criticising them, and they're not and give logical, pragmatic arguments like I'm presenting on the web with the BBC programme that I got put out, Anything to Declare and things like that, about how they should stand themselves down and don't. And this in itself leads people to believe that Freemasonry is an unhealthy thing because it is open to abuse by public servants to cover up wrongdoing.
So what about these secret handshakes? Tell us how the secret handshakes work.
Well, if you go to Mason's Corner on the website at www.dorsetvictimsupport.org, which is another site I launched following my win over dorsetpolice.com with the ICANN tribunal, I've published on there all of the handshakes and the signs and the different signs that they give.
Oh, okay. So is it a sort of pressure to knuckles?
They will apply pressure to the first knuckle for the lowest level Freemason, the initiated apprentice.
That's the first degree, yeah.
Then the second degree to the centre knuckle, the third degree will be the third knuckle.
So it's not just a secret handshake. There's a different secret handshake for the different degrees.
And there's also Masonic grips, and these grips have got names. I can't remember them offhand, but if you go to the website, it's all up there, where we've managed to get hold of their material. Certain Masonic books and material that state all this and their rituals, and we've published it.
Now, one of the most important things, of course, is knowing which Freemasons are in which lodges, because they try and keep this information very secret. So what is this book you were talking about that you managed to get for Dorset?
Well, I managed to get hold of a Dorset yearbook, and in the Dorset yearbook, at the back pages, there is a directory, alphabetical directory, of every single craft level, that is the first two levels of Freemasonry. Well, it covers the three Master Masons as well. Then there is another index in pink pages, which are Mark and Ram degree Masons. They're and then there is a green index, again alphabetical, which are Rose-Croix and 33rd degree Freemasons. And so these are the different levels of Freemasonry. In there is the name and lodge number of every single Mason in Dorset.
Now, does each Masonic province, because actually Bristol itself is a Masonic province, rather than a county, Bristol, a city, is a Masonic province. Does each Masonic province publish one of these books?
Yeah, each Masonic province publishes a book. Normally, provinces are done on county lines.
And is it an annual publication?
It's an annual publication.
So how do you go about, this is the difficult thing, isn't it? How do you go about getting hold of one of these books? Because I imagine they keep them quite close to their chest, the Freemasons.
It's very hard to get hold of current books in the current year, because the only way you'll get one is from a member who's had one sent to him. But there are ways of getting hold of these books. They do turn up from time to time. Usually when someone leaves Freemasonry and is disposing of everything, or when someone passes away or something like that, and the widow's clearing everything out, these books are around, and if you make inquiries, you can get these. I mean, I don't particularly want to go into exactly how I got the books I've got, but suffice to say, I've got a number of them for different parts of this country.
Well, I think it makes sense actually to put out an appeal now. If anyone out there has got a Masonic yearbook for Bristol from one of the last few years, we very much appreciate having one on this programme. So you can drop it into BCFM, put it for my attention, Tony Gosling, here at BCFM, which is part of the City Academy. It's in the Beacon Centre in Russell Town Avenue, in sort of Lawrence Hill part of Bristol.
Also, okay. I'll pay £30 for any book that is dropped in. All right, so that we can then copy those and put them into our archive. Only Bristol, but we would like to get hold of any other books relating to Avon and Somerset, relating to Sussex, relating to many other areas.
So if anyone is needs sort of this kind of thing, I mean, whereabouts? You can't get these in ordinary bookshops, though, can you, Jerry?
No, you can't. I mean, these books, you're lucky if you come across them. In fact, the original Dorset book that I got in 95 was actually handed to me by a councillor who's now deceased, whose husband was a Mason. And as I said to you when I was doing this research, a lot of the husbands who are Masons push their wives into public office, like they'll push their wives to become magistrates, councillors or something. So even if the incumbent Mason is not... for example, as I mentioned, the Gawsons, you've got County Councillor Gawson. His wife, Elaine Gawson, is one of the female magistrates. And he is in the same lodge as the male magistrates and a lot of the other councillors.
What about these lodge meetings, though, Jerry, that you mentioned? There's actually a formal meeting of the lodge and a festive board. What's the difference between the two and what are they?
Well, the formal meeting of the lodge is where the lodge will open up and it will go through its formalities and it will go through its rituals. And depending on what level you are within that lodge, you will be allowed in that meeting, probably from the opening right up till the end. If you are, say, an initiated apprentice or a craft level Mason, you will go through the lodge rituals as far as your level. Then you will be asked to leave and you'll go to the robing room or to another area or another room outside where the lodge meeting's going on. And then the other superior degrees will continue with their rituals and their floor work. And then the inferior degrees will be invited back in at the closing of the lodge meeting, and then everyone will sit down at the festive board. In other words, they'll all have a dinner together and after the lodge meeting.
So we've all heard of the Grand Master, because each lodge has its Grand Master.
Well, each
province, isn't it?
Each lodge has a master of the lodge. Then you get a deacon, you get superintendents, and these cover the province, if you like, and the Grand Master is usually the main master in charge of the province.
Now, I know also a senior former Knights Templar Freemason who left Freemasonry, and he described it as at the top evil. Is that something that you would say?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were an organisation of crusading knights who got so powerful because they had actually got the first international money movements, banking system and God knows what going on between all the staging posts and forts that were built while they were invading the Holy Land. When they came back, His Holiness the Pope ordered them to be disbanded because they were a subversive threat. And the Knights Templar actually went underground, and it finally was resurrected in Freemasonry. And where, one, believe it or not, one of the first seats of the Knights Templar resurrecting was in blooming Hertfordshire. I've got a Hertfordshire book, and if you go to www.rottenborough.org, which is run by a former councillor, Ian Johnson, in Hertfordshire, I gave him some images of Knights Templar masons with swords and fezes on their head and dressed as crusading knights and uniformed. This is a uniformed private army in Hertfordshire.
Oh, crikey. Anyway, just to remind listeners of your websites, it's dorsetpolice.com and dorsetvictimsupport.org. And I think you've just got a new one, haven't you?
Yes, dorsetpolice.tv, because with the broadband, we're now showing the documentary films like Anything to Declare.
Right, Jerry Coulter, thank you very much. And good sources on the Freemasons in order of publication. There's a book called Darkness Visible, The Brotherhood by Stephen Knight, Inside the Brotherhood by Martin Short, which is also a six-part video documentary available on the internet. And for more on things like the Rosicrucians, the Freemasons, the Golden Dawn, Neo-Paganism, there are several obscure authors on the subject with direct knowledge. That's Montague Summers, Rollo Ahmed, and Aleister Crowley himself, who's the old 666, apparently from the 1940s, all of which, incidentally, were interviewed at length by World War II Whitehall deception planner and author Dennis Wheatley, who used much of what he found in his occult and historical novels. An obligatory word of warning, though: the occult can be a trap for those who crave power. Do please be careful to use any knowledge you gain to understand, but not to practice this potentially dangerous craft. Wheatley also edited a 50 or strong collection published by Sphere Books called The Library of the Occult, which includes a collection of essays on Satanism and witches, with essays by everyone from Crowley to Robert Graves. Last but not least, published in the New English Library, is the most readable Francis King, author of Ritual Magic from 1887 to the present day, and several other balanced but entertaining books. Well, if you're thinking, where on earth will I find these books? The answer is simple these days, if you have access to the internet. All these are secondhand, and there's plenty of websites where you can locate them. Apart from the obvious one, which is anti-trade union Amazon, there is German company Abe Books and the excellent bookfinder.com. There's also a very good feature film called A Very British Coup. That's all for this week. Coming up next, Sky News at 7. Thanks very much to our guest, Westbury-on-Trim councillor and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop, and to Jerry Coulter, also to Marina Morris, and to old Labour economist Martin Summers. Next week, Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith, and someone from the Public Service Union, PCS.